that gosh darn Bob, you won't believe what he did, and I'm leaving him.
Yeah. It's so much easier to do it the second way, though.
It is, isn't it?
Well, and that's why I wanted to give this advice out.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in.
From heart-wrenching tragedy and injustice to vindication, one man's journey to clear his name of murdering his wife and the power of DNA evidence.
Then be ready to rev up your engines and head out on the highway with motorcycle adventures.
Plus the importance of having a financial date with your partner.
Then the wiser divorce. Is that even possible?
And we'll shoot the breeze about one very cool ferry boat captain.
On August 13, 1986, Michael Morton's wife was found brutally bludgeoned to death in the couple's bed. 6 months later, Michael was convicted of her murder and sentenced to life in prison. This despite a lack of any physical evidence. In fact, the prosecutor in the case suppressed the evidence that would have exonerated him.
Michael spent nearly 25 years in prison before his grave miscarriage of justice was brought to light. He was set free in 2011. He chronicles his story of unfathomable tragedy and injustice, but ultimately strength and courage in his memoir, Getting Life. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Michael, can you set the scene? Take us back to that day when your nightmare began in 1986, when your wife, Chris, was brutally murdered. How did you discover she had been murdered?
Well, I had gone to retrieve my son from the babysitter. Remember, we were incredibly, almost comically average people. Middle class, we both had careers, had a child, we're thinking of another mortgage, you know, the corner lot, nice suburban neighborhood. But anyway, I went to pick up my son at the babysitter's, and he wasn't there. Very unusual. So I made a phone call, the sheriff answered, and I headed home. He wouldn't tell me anything. I learned of my wife's death in my front yard because the house was surrounded by a crime scene ribbon. There were police everywhere, neighbors across the street on the sidewalks looking and whispering and pointing. Not your stereotypical death notice, but it was what it was.
Mm. Well, Michael, why did the police zero in on you from the very beginning?
It became pretty clear to me that I was their one and only suspect. And I've chewed on that question and tried to digest it and make sense of it for over 25 years now. But I don't have an answer that I can verify that I know it's true. The prosecutor won't talk to me, and the sheriff is deceased.
Did you have a police record at all? Anything in your background that might have made you suspicious to the police?
Well, the extent of my criminal record was a couple traffic tickets. I had no felonies, no misdemeanors. I mean, it was just comically void. There was, you know, most people don't have criminal histories. And for whatever reason, the sheriff arrived at the crime scene. He looked around, saw a few little things, and decided I did it. One of them might have been a snarky little note that I left my late wife. Having said that, one person I know in the media read it and burst out laughing. And I asked him what was so funny. I didn't think it was funny, but what he thought or what he saw when he read that note that I left her. And it was about not having sex on my birthday. And he started laughing because he said it's so quintessential married couple stuff. It's just like, you know, this is what, you know, married people complain about or fight about or whatever. And I would either have to be the most brilliant, manipulative criminal in the world to leave a note like that behind, or I was such a clueless buffoon that I left this note that just, you know, pointed at me. And a lot of investigators I've spoken to since read that note and said, you know, this is like a neon sign pointing away from you. It's so open and honest. So, oh well.
At your trial, the jury deliberated for just 2 hours before actually sentencing you to life in prison. And of course, that was a time before DNA testing was even available. But there was no physical evidence linking you to the crime. So how did they convict you?
The prosecutor depended on what I called emotional pleas. And he did a lot of acting, and he cried. And there was one piece of evidence that he did use that was very misleading, and he misrepresented it. And the medical examiner came back afterwards and said, that's not what I said. But the point I'm getting at is that one of the things the prosecutor did was try to establish time of death. And it cannot be done with the evidence at hand. But originally, the first autopsy report listed my wife's time of death after I left for work that morning. And after a little powwow with the sheriff, the medical examiner changed his time of death 3 or 4 hours and clearly placing my wife's murder while I was still home. There was a lot of debate and argument over that time of death. Experts came in, experts left. At the end of the day, the prosecutor relied on that secondary time of death, that adjusted time of death, that was very damning to me.
Well, Michael, let's talk about the prosecutor, Ken Anderson, and the evidence that was suppressed that would really have exonerated you. So your 3-year-old son at the time told his grandmother that, and I quote here, a monster with a big mustache hit his mother. And he also said that you were not present in the house at the time of the killing. So what, if anything, was done with that information? Was it ever investigated at all?
Apparently, they were just trying to work around and how could they get around this and dodge this, because they thought that I might have known some of this stuff. But the fact of it is, my mother-in-law never shared that with us, and everyone was concerned about my son. And so I took him to several child psychologists trying to find one, at least, that he had some sort of rapport with. And I'd be honest with you, after my wife's murder, I was pretty shook up, and I recognized that I was in no position to help my son. So I was taking him to professionals. And unfortunately, they didn't unpack this either from that little boy. He was a traumatized little child who just lost his mother. And the professionals didn't even find this. As you can imagine, while my son was my main focus, I was very compartmentalized. I had to go back to work. I was dealing with all the lawyers. I had a murder investigation going on. I was the subject of that. The trial, you know, on and on and on. And while my son was primary, I was hoping the professionals knew what they were doing.
All right. And your son was really the only witness to the crime.
Yes, amazingly so. I don't know if they could have actually used a 3-year-old child at that time as a witness in a court of law, because, you know, cross-examination, all sorts of legal niceties come up. But just from an investigative point of view, they already had their man in their minds, and so they just had to, how can we, you know, discount this child?
Was there any other evidence that was suppressed?
Amazingly, as DNA developed and we were getting our tests, slowly they were allowing us to run some tests, the Innocence Project is a pretty good group, and so as any competent attorney will do, they had a plan B. And what that was, this was a parallel attack on my conviction, and just one of the things they tried was what we call in Texas the Texas Open Records Act, and it's similar to Freedom of Information Act. And we got access to the sheriff's and the district attorney's files from 1986 and 1987. The other things that were in those files were reports from the sheriff's office about a neighbor reporting a man driving a van parking behind our house a couple of times, going into the woods behind our house and looking us over, kind of casing the joint, you might say. There was another thing in the file about my wife's credit card being used after her death, and there was something else in the file about a check being cashed after her death. Whether these things were relevant or not, on top of what's been referred to as the monster transcript that my son spoke of, the deal is that that stuff had been suppressed. That's against the law.
Our guest is Michael Morton. He spent 25 years in prison accused of brutally murdering his wife. DNA evidence cleared his name. His memoir is called Getting Life. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes Radio Hour, and I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Michael Morton. Michael, I want to just go back a bit to your son, who was so young when you went to prison. How old was he?
When I went inside, he was 3 and a half. We were very, very close. He was a, you know, almost every parent will tell you that, you know, before you have a child, it's all about you. But after you have a child, the focus of your life changes. And it was doubly so with my wife and I, because my son was born with congenital heart defect. And just a few months prior to my wife's murder, my son underwent heart surgery. And he, you know, he's perfectly fine after that. Problem was solved. But all those years of having a sick little boy, the medication, the hospital visits, we were very tightly connected. It was a very tight bond. And one of the worst times was actually being arrested when the police had to pull him from my arms. He's crying and screaming and calling for me. And that was one of the worst points.
Can't even imagine. But did he grow up thinking that you murdered his mother?
Yes. After I was convicted, he was given to by the court. He was given to my in-laws. In fact, my sister-in-law raised him. He was brought to me every 6 months in the penitentiary to visit, but 6 months in the life of a child is an eternity. And I was slowly watching him grow up and grow farther and farther away. And he was believing what the people told him who were raising him. I was the bad guy. I had, you know, killed his mother. And they didn't, I've learned that they didn't talk about it a lot. In fact, they almost never talked about it except at special occasions. But he did, in fact, grow up believing that I'd murdered his mother.
What is your relationship like now with your son, Eric?
We have reunited. He's had a very tough time because things that he thought he knew that were foundational in his life, he's had to reinterpret and reinvent and try to change. I mean, he's had to wrap his head around a new reality, and it's been tough for him. But I'm very proud of him. He's gotten through it. He's my son now. We're back. We have a normal relationship. He is married. I've since remarried. I have two grandchildren. My son provided. It's a very wonderful relationship. It's everything I hoped it would be and a little bit more.
How on earth did you manage to stay sane while you were in prison?
Well, I had some very dark years, but the short answer is it was the grace of God and a guy's tendency sometimes to compartmentalize. And, you know, you have your issues you have to deal with in the penitentiary, and they can be immediate and foremost and right in your face. And you've got your legal woes going on that you have to deal with kind of separately. You've got your family connections you're trying to take care of and nurture. And that's one of the lessons I've learned that I really hope other people get from this, is that no matter what you're going through, marital woes, financial health, you can get through it. Anybody and everybody listening should know that they are a lot tougher than they think they are.
Well, Michael, let's talk quickly about the Innocence Project. That's the lawyers' organization that fights for people like you. And what you said, you know, they eventually got involved in your case. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the DNA evidence that came to light that really eventually exonerated you.
More than once, I've referred to the people at the Innocence Project as saints. They certainly seem that way to me. What happened in my case was actually my brother-in-law is the one who found a bandana behind our house. And he was upset early on with what he thought was rather poor police work. And he went looking around for evidence they may have missed or just simply discounted. And he found that bandana, and he thought it had some dark stains on it that might be blood. Well, he sealed it up. He had a little bit of a scientific background, delivered to the police, and they, in fact, tested it, and there was human blood on it. But remember, it was 1986. Technology wasn't very advanced in that regard. They could just, you know, they could type the blood, but if they didn't have someone to test it against, there wasn't much they could do. The Institute Project offered to pay all fees, lab costs, transportation, whatever it took. Just they would ask him for access to that bandana. We tested a lot of things from the crime scene, but that bandana, eventually we found that it had my wife's DNA and another man's DNA commingled together on this bandana, clearly placing this other person at the crime scene.
And was that man, who I understand is Mark Allen Norwood, was he eventually convicted of your wife's murder?
Yes. First of all, we just found that there was a man's DNA on that bandana. Then they ran the information through CODIS, which is the DNA database. His name popped up when he did time in California. He had a long criminal history. He definitely had opportunity. And he was the man who killed my wife. He was convicted. He is also indicted on another murder 17 months after my wife's murder. So while I was inside, he killed somebody else. He will be tried for that. I believe it's in February of next year. And there are a lot of very disturbing similarities between the cases. And there's some suspicion that there may be some more women. It's very, very creepy, real dark, strange coincidences. But he is now sitting in the Texas penitentiary with a life sentence, and he doesn't have a very bright future.
Michael, what was it like to actually walk out of prison after 25 years with the world knowing you were really innocent?
The day I walked out was a genuine metamorphosis. I mean, if beforehand, I had been the boogeyman in the media. I was a murderous perv. I was a monster. I was all these horrible things. And it was, you know, torches and pitchforks, and they're coming to get me. But when everything turned around, the DNA exonerated me. The people in the media, the reporters, the journalists, they were besides themselves trying to, I guess you could say, make up for what had happened. They were gracious and kind and all over the place, and some of them were crying. They were just an amazing thing. One of the things that happened when I left the courthouse that day is there was an attorney with us, and he'd been practicing law for, I think, 30 or 40 years. And he noticed at the back of the courthouse, so they had a balcony, was lined with policemen and courthouse and jail employees, and they were applauding and waving to me. He said he had never seen that in all his years of practice. It was like walking into a new world. I left one of concrete and steel and went to one of absolute bliss and liberty.
Michael Morton, thanks so much for sharing your ordeal with us. Michael's memoir is called Getting Life. We wish you all the best.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Barb and I won't torture you by singing Born to be Wild, but we sure know the words. Get your motor running, heading out on the highway, looking for adventure and whatever comes our way.
Born to be wild.
Well, you get the picture.
Well, for many boomers, a motorcycle adventure is on their bucket list. I mean, after all, we're looking for adventure. We may not own a motorcycle, and we could be absolutely clueless about which highway to head out on first. So here to tell us how to get our motors running is Chris McIntyre, the president of Eagle Rider Motorcycle Rentals, a motorcycle tourism company. He joins us on the phone from L.A. Great to have you with us, Chris.
Thank you very much. It's a beautiful sunny day, and I was just wild on the 405 freeway on the way to work.
Oh, on the two-wheeler, huh? Well, Chris, just to get it out there, I'm sure most people know this. I mean, we babes don't even own a motorcycle. We don't have one of those cute little leather outfits or even a bandana.
We want them, though.
We do want them.
Yeah.
But we haven't a clue how to ride a motorcycle, and we're looking for adventure. You know, would we be able to go on one of your trips?
Absolutely. So you're talking to a guy that had a dream. I was stuck in a ninth-floor building of AT&T in L.A., and I was looking at my boss across the way, his hair balding, and stuck in his office, probably has $1 million in stock options. And I thought, man, at 25, 26 years old, I'm like, this isn't for me. I better figure out to do something on my own that's more aligned and in tune with my passion. And I'm very fortunate, as you guys are, really doing something that you love. And if you're able to do something you love, with people you love, and you're passionate about it, honestly, if you have a plan, it's almost impossible not to succeed. So we started with four Harley Davidsons in a small LA garage, and today we have over 4,000 motorcycles. And to answer your question, we do everything from throw the keys to somebody and jump in the, you know, just like you jump in a car at Enterprise Rent-A-Car, we can throw keys and they can jump on the motorcycle of their choice and just rent it. But as we started to grow the business, there's many people like you two that want the experience, want the exhilaration, but they maybe don't ride. So we've done everything from in Vegas, Harleys to Hoover Dam, passenger tours for bachelorette parties. We have guided tours, self-drive tours. Let's face it, women make most decisions, I think, in the household and entertainment, or it has to be at least joint. So, you know, if it was my wife and I told her I was going on a 14-day motorcycle trip, she'd be like, oh, no way am I on the back. So Eagle Rider created everything from classic cars as chase vehicles. So you two could actually be in a convertible Mustang, old Cadillac, not only acting as a luggage vehicle for the motorcycle group, all the guys or whoever rides, and still get the same Americana on old Route 66, see beautiful destinations. We get it on two wheels. And when you guys are interested, you can jump on the back and or ride in the chase vehicle. Ooh. So we do it all.
Well, I don't know. I think we should be driving the motorcycles, Barbara.
Well, I don't know. I like the idea of the car, but at least it has to be a convertible, Chris.
Oh, yeah, and maybe a Porsche.
You guys are good.
I mean, we want something really classy with our hair blowing in the wind. I can just see it.
Well, you're going to love one thing. We work very closely with an organization called Motorcycle Safety Foundation, and guess what they do?
They teach you how to ride motorcycles?
You got it. Just like when you go, when the ski industry years ago, before there was Vail Mountain, Jackson Hole, there was a flourishing multi-million-dollar ski industry in the Alps. It came to America and it was non-existent. So one of the things that some interesting entrepreneurs that created the ski industry did is they started creating something called a ski school. Now, you and I both know we're not going to become Olympic skiers going down Black Diamond or Triple Black Diamond mountain slopes in Aspen or Jackson Hole or Park City from one ski lesson. But what it does is it provides you the ability to learn how to safely navigate a snowboard or ski, and you take the terrain that is appropriate for your level. And we do the exact same thing with the Motorcycle Safety Foundation and numerous others. And we have guides in front and back. It's almost like a pod that we have certain areas where we go down the road, and you can still have the exhilaration of operating a motorcycle in a very, very safe environment. And name it, I'll make your dream come true on two wheels.
Ooh, this is sounding better and better. This is Kathy and Barb, the two Boomer Babes. We're talking about guided tours for biker wannabes with Chris McIntyre, president of Eagle Rider Motorcycle Rentals. So, Chris, who actually goes on these trips? I mean, babes like us?
By the way, I got to tell you guys, I love your enthusiasm. I love how you guys call yourself the Boomer Babes. You are meant for Eagle Rider. Come on.
Okay, we'll
so
do it.
Who goes on? Honestly, you guys are perfect. I can tell from your personalities and your need for interesting and exotic things and adventure. And let's face it, who goes on it? People that want to go ahead and see beautiful things, it's a travel business, so it just happens to be on two wheels and open, and all your senses are really tantalized by operating a motorcycle. We probably, this year, will have close to 75,000 total customers, and of those people, I would say a little over 50% are going to be international, because the dollar, America's on sale for international travels because the euro and the pound is so strong. So we have tons of international customers that are coming over to experience Yosemite, Route 66, Pacific Coast Highway, you name it, you know, the destination. But they're motorcycle enthusiasts. So we're really niche where we just target the motorcycle enthusiasts but come to America. Then the other roughly 48% or 50% is U.S.-based people. It could be a guy from New York, and husband and wife that love motorcycling that are out for a movie production or something in L.A., and they have free time. So they will literally pick up an Eagle Rider and take a one-way trip up the coast to San Francisco, drop off, and fly back to New York. So it's really travel-based and destination-based.
Well, how do you actually target this niche? I mean, what do you do? Like, you have a Facebook page, or you're out on the Internet? Or I mean, how do you really find those customers?
Content is king. It's the beauty of the Internet is that it makes companies unique and niche, such as Eagle Rider and motorcycle tourism, really available for anyone who's doing a search, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's on TripAdvisor, whether it's on Google, and they search motorcycle vacations Grand Canyon. We will come up. And so all we do is we provide beautiful content. When I say content, it's three levels. It's written, so it's you know, you're able to be find it on search engines. Two, images, because let's face it, images, beautiful, beautiful images of an experience really is what you look for when you see a vacation or choose a hotel. And then we have video content of actually people like you that are maybe apprehensive, just got their license, aren't really sure about what they're going to embark upon. And then you watch the development of your ride to the very end, your testimonial says it all. And that's literally how we started from 4 bikes, went to 8 bikes, 8 bikes went to 80 bikes, 80 bikes went to 800. And it's literally word of mouth, testimonials, and we primarily do it on the internet or travel shows.
Okay, Chris. So you have lots of options. We know it's international and national, but if we just wanted to get our feet wet in the world of motorcycle adventures, like Kathy and I, tell us about a trip that you'd recommend for us.
Where do you want to go? First, you have to pick a destination.
Out west. Let's go out west.
Oh, California, the coastal roads, whatever.
Okay. So what we would do, and to get your feet wet, is to me, would be minimum 2 to 3 days. So a beautiful, beautiful three-day trip. You would fly in, and I wouldn't do it because, you know, I'm going to get one of my most handsome, buff, cool dudes that's going to be at the airport to pick you up.
Ooh, only one?
Can I ride on the back of his motorcycle, Chris?
Okay,
please?
So skip.
How about
skip,
two?
Skip about our convenience of offering vans to pick you up. I'm going to have two incredibly handsome guys and a van that will carry your luggage, by the way.
This is sounding better because I come with a lot of shoes.
No, actually, it's funny you say that. The reason we have luggage vehicles and we have luggage storage and we ship from FedEx from one location overnight to another is because people like you, God bless you, have literally, no joke, have brought a suitcase full of shoes.
Well, Chris McIntyre, president of Eagle Rider Motorcycle Rentals, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes, and maybe we'll see you on the open road one of these days.
Love you, Boomer Babes.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. Up next, the importance of having that financial convo with your honey. We'll be right back. Money is a complicated and difficult topic for couples. One partner may be the spender, the other the saver. One a donor, the other a hoarder. Our next guest believes that when couples understand each partner's differences and have ongoing financial conversations, this will enhance their finances and relationship.
Nicole Minnendorf is a professional financial advisor and the author of Lipstick on the Piggy Bank, Secrets Every Woman Should Know About Happiness, Money, and Independence. She joins us from the Twin Cities. Welcome, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
You write that men and women are really different when it comes to money. So tell us how so.
Specifically when it comes to money, there's things that women have going against us. Studies still show that we're making less money. We also live longer. And we tend to always put other people first instead of ourselves. And so we're putting our kids first, or family first, or friends first. And so we actually start saving later in life. And once we finally start saving, we save less than men. And then one of my big arguments is that I think it costs us more as women to live. I love it when I have couples in my office and the husband will point the finger at the wife and say, well, she's the one that spends all the money. And then she's pointing the finger at him saying, well, he's the one that spends all the money. You know, I mean, both of us spend money. We just spend money on different things. Look at dry cleaning. It costs more for us as women to get our clothes dry cleaned than men. It's small things like that that can add up, that can make a difference.
So what are topics that should be part of an ongoing conversation?
Well, I'm a big advocate of having a money date. And so I was married, I'm divorced, but when I was married, the money date was twice a month. And so for some couples, it's once a week, some couples, it's once a month. But I recommend maybe the first time you do it, if you haven't had a money date yet, that you need to go into a public restaurant. If money is kind of a heated topic for you, sit down and use the variety of different things that are going on in your situation and take them one at a time. So you start first with, most people don't know what their net worth is. So start first with that. You know, what are all of your assets? What are all of your liabilities? What are the interest rates on credit cards? What's the interest rate on your mortgage? Answering really the questions of what if. What if I die? What if my spouse dies? What if I want to retire at 50, 60? What if my kids, you know, have a phenomenal schooling and they want to go to Harvard? Or what if they don't? It's all those, what if I get a car accident? And so the topics are unbelievable from looking at when's the last time you reviewed your cell phone plan or your cable bill or your health insurance or your life insurance. So you can look at things from a month-to-month cash flow basis, and that's what usually women are focused on, is paying the bills. What do we have coming in? What do we have going out? And how do we protect everything? And men in general tend to be more focused on the investments. And so that can be another topic, is how is my 401k invested? Do we have a Roth IRA? Should we have a Roth IRA? Really, you could have a money date every single day of the year, because there's so many things that relate and correlate to money. And it could be anything from, oh, you know, are we giving our kids an allowance? Should we give our kids an allowance? Okay, if we give them an allowance, how much should it be? It's pretty vast. Anything related to money you can talk about.
This is Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes, and we are speaking with Nicole Mindendorf, financial advisor and author of Lipstick on the Piggy Bank, about the importance of having that ongoing financial conversation with your spouse. Nicole, who is more likely to search for that big deal?
Women. I use the analogy of when you're investing, you can invest in large size companies, and there's the difference between value and growth. And so you can invest in a growth size company that has, most of the time you can think of like a tech company or something that has growth potential. Value is a company that's maybe been around for a while, but is a better deal. And women are fabulous value investors, and we're always looking for that deal. We love consignment shops. We love garage sales or Craigslist or, you know, things of that nature to try to find a discount. Coupons, I'm a big fan of Groupon now. But we're always looking for how can we save. And so I give the analogy of, okay, a great value investment is looking at, you have this red sweater and it's on sale. And there's two choices you have: a red sweater that was originally $100 that's cashmere, that's on sale for $20, or just a regular traditional sweater that was originally $50 and it's on sale for $20. Which one's a better deal?
Well, it depends if the cashmere's from China or from Scotland.
Great point.
You got to know your value or which ones I can return.
Yes, so really it's looking at, women are great value investors, and we're always looking for that great big deal. We're looking for what's the smartest thing for us to do. And that's why, you know, women get touted that we're more conservative as investors and we tend to not necessarily talk about money. I don't agree with that. Women don't hesitate to ask for directions, so women don't hesitate to enlist the help of a financial advisor. Women do not hesitate to come into my office and sit down in front of me. Women don't hesitate to attend a seminar. The attendance at our events, and that's why I do so much for women, is because men kind of have this been raised that, oh, I know this stuff, where women are like, gosh, I don't know about much about money, and so let me learn. And so women are not hesitant to ask questions and get direction and get guidance, and we take time on the front end to learn about things, and then when we make a decision, we stick with it, and that's why we tend to be better investors.
Well, Nicole, finally, can you tell us what your number one best piece of advice for having a healthy financial relationship might be?
The biggest thing is communication. And so pick a topic and figure out, okay, what makes the most sense? Because a lot of times, you know, I just had this conversation yesterday with a client. He had bought a stock and the stock has done really well and we're looking at selling it. And I come back to the question of, well, why did you buy it in the first place? You know, I got to sell this. I'm like, well, why did you buy it in the first place? You told me when you bought it that you wanted to own this company forever. So why are you so agitated and excited to sell it? It always comes back to why you bought something. So let's say life insurance. Okay, you bought life insurance 20 years ago. Well, why do you have it today? Does it really make sense? Do you know that you can actually sell your life insurance policy and maybe get some money from it? There's amazing resources. There's tons of companies, and like specifically if you're looking for stock investments, there's Yahoo Finance. Our website has tons of things. If you're looking for life insurance resources, GWG Life is a great company you can go to. And so it's really getting information and getting education and then communicating with your significant other or whomever you're in a relationship with about that. And it's really making sure that you're listening. The biggest thing that I see, I mean, many days I feel like like a counselor. And sometimes maybe you have your money date with your financial advisor until you really get that communication going. Because sometimes spouses will talk down to the other person or try to nag the other person. And it's really imperative that you don't do that. You really want to have communication and get education and get understanding. And most of the time, women are great at asking questions, and don't be hesitant to ask those questions. Because a lot of times, the men are wanting to ask those questions, but they don't ask them because they don't want to look stupid. So make sure you ask the questions when it comes to your money.
Well, Nicole Minnendorf, financial advisor and author of Lipstick on the Piggy Bank, Secrets Every Woman Should Know About Happiness, Money, and Independence. Thanks so much for sharing your great advice with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you.
Divorce, by definition, is the legal process of ending a marriage. It's also a life crisis where emotions are riddled with animosity. Divorce can be a financial money pit. Is there a better way to divorce? A way to minimize the hostility, reduce the courtroom battles, and huge legal fees? Attorney Angie Hollier says that the wiser divorce can and does occur. She is the managing partner of a family law firm in Arizona and also the author of the book, The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. Angie joins us from Phoenix. Glad to have you with us, Angie.
Oh, so happy to be here, Barbara and Kathy.
Divorce is horrible. You know, tempers flare and emotions run high. But you say that it doesn't necessarily have to be adversarial or come to being a high-stakes battleground. So what are some strategies for avoiding a really nasty divorce?
First of all, I really try to help people through my book think about how their words, how their thoughts, and how their acts will really impact the divorce process and the next part of their life. I wrote this book because I firmly believe, and I've seen it happen, what comes after divorce can be the best part of a person's life. But they need to think about that next life while they're going through the divorce, and they need some of these specific strategies. Some of the strategies include things like thinking of this divorce process as a business. If people have a business, they plan their business. They set goals for their business. They have a way to execute those goals. And they're wise about money. With all the emotions that happen in a divorce, people do anything but execute a good business plan. They spend their money foolishly, they don't set goals, they don't see where they're going, and they let all those emotions just mess up the whole process.
Angie, how do you keep the emotion out of it, though? I mean, I would imagine it would be just overwhelmingly emotional.
One of the things I advise people in my book is to think of divorce as a series of rooms in your house. And so when you're working with your attorney and you're working on the legal part and you're working on who's going to get what and what will happen with the children, envision that as the divorce process room, that legal room. You have to have other rooms in the house for dealing with your emotions, for dealing with interactions with your children, for dealing with interactions with family members and friends. But you really have to focus when you're working through the legal process on sitting in that room, because that's where people get messed up. That's where they make their divorces a disaster, because they bring in all that baggage and all that bad communication they had in their marriage into the divorce room.
So you're saying to kind of compartmentalize things.
Yes, it really does help. I even suggest in the book doing some scripting. Think about, what are the words you want to use when you're talking to others about your divorce? What are the words you want to use when you're talking to your soon-to-be ex in front of the children? What are the words you want to use when you're announcing your divorce? Because all those things come back to bite you if you don't do it right. We all know how family and friends line up behind the person they think is in the right. And the person who they think is in the wrong is now this bad, evildoer. There's really a way to totally switch that mindset. Saying things like, you know, Bob and I have decided to get divorced. I wanted to let you know we have agreed to be respectful to each other. We're going to do what's best for our children, and I hope you'll still be friends with both of us. That's a very different way of approaching it than that gosh darn Bob, you won't believe what he did, and I'm leaving him.
Yeah. It's so much easier to do it the second way, though.
It is, isn't it?
Well, and that's why I wanted to give this advice out, because after almost 25 years of practicing family law, I really see, because I see it from the beginning to the end. I see the women or the men who come in and they're just distraught or they're angry or they want revenge. And I see the difference at the end for those who were able to deal with this in a more mature, rational way, who bring their best selves to the divorce, you know, those characteristics that they want people to admire in them, when you go through it like that, what happens on the back end can just be wonderful.
So, Angie, what do you think about the approach that Gwyneth Paltrow and Chris Martin have taken, sort of the conscious uncoupling?
Right. It's so funny because I was in the midst of finalizing this book when that came out. And it really is what I'm saying. You purposefully and you consciously walk through this process. And again, divorce is just the legal way to end a contract of marriage. And when you can see the good in the marriage and take responsibility for the bad, you really can consciously uncouple. There's some tools in my book to help people work through that. One of the things I like people to look at is, what did you gain from this marriage? I mean, it may not be the person you should be married to now, but I bet everyone who's getting a divorce can point to things that happened in the marriage that they'll be able to take forward. Did they learn a new skill? Did they travel somewhere? What is that that you got out of it you're going to take forward? Then make a list of what you want to lose, like lose it and forget it. And then regain what you lost, because if you're at the point of divorce, you've probably lost something in your life that you loved to do, you're not taking advantage of. And when you do it like that, I think it really can be a conscious uncoupling.
If you've just tuned in, this is Barb and Kathy, the Two Boomer Babes. We're talking strategies for a wiser divorce with attorney Angie Hollier. So Angie, let's switch gears a bit and talk about finding the right attorney. How do we do that?
That's one of the most important decisions you'll make in a divorce, is to find the right attorney. It's not just the right attorney, it's the right attorney for you. Every divorce attorney has a personality and approach that may be different than the next one. And I tell people, you really should interview more than one attorney, even if the first one seems like a perfect fit, because this is such an emotional area of law. You really want to feel like you've got someone that you have confidence in, that you agree with the way that they're proposing the strategy be, and that you feel has your back. I do an analogy to a doctor. You know, some people go to a doctor, and this isn't how I like my doctors to be, but some people go to their doctor and he says, okay, you have this disease, here's your pill, go home, take it every night, and people say, okay. You know, other doctors say, here's what you have, here are the four different treatment options we have for what you have, here is the one I would recommend and why, and here is how I need you to be involved in your treatment. That's what a good divorce attorney will do.
Can you name just a few common mistakes that people make when looking for an attorney or when choosing an attorney? What are the pitfalls?
The pitfalls are looking for a bulldog or finding a bulldog, looking for someone who you think will attack your soon-to-be ex and exact the revenge that you want, and be the mouthpiece for your anger, because there are bulldog attorneys out there. And, you know, I have to be one sometimes when called upon to be one, but I hope that's very rare. And really good attorneys will focus on settlements. So if you want a bulldog, that's not a good option. If you find an attorney in an interview who is immediately bad-mouthing your soon-to-be ex or the other attorney, that's not a good sign, because it means they may lose perspective and your battle will become their battle. You want an attorney who has that objective perspective, because that's what you need as you walk through this. You have to have someone who's absolutely honest with you, even if you don't like what you hear.
And Angie, attorneys are so incredibly expensive. I mean, how does a couple get through a divorce with some money left in the bank? Is it possible to negotiate terms or rates?
Right. It is so important to think about your money as you're strategically going through your divorce. Because, again, if you're going to have a great life on the other end, you want as much money as possible for that life. So, you know, attorneys are sand through the hourglass. We charge for our time, not for our results. We can be your counselor. We can be, you know, talk to all your friends and family if you think, but that's just money drifting away and dribbling away. So there's so many options now for divorcing couples. There's a method of divorce called collaborative divorce, which is one of my favorite ways to do divorces. And it's really like a series of board meetings with team members, you know, an attorney for each side, a divorce coach for each side, a financial expert, a child expert. And it really is a good strategic use of money, because those kind of meetings can get your divorces done in just a few months. So a lot of attorneys won't, to go back to your other question, they're not going to negotiate their rates, but you can certainly have control over how much you spend with them.
And what about going the arbitration route? I mean, is that more like the collaborative divorce?
Yes.
Game plan?
So, a collaborative divorce is a very specific method with this team in place, but you can utilize those kind of strategies in any divorce. I absolutely believe that most divorces should start out with any divorce, with a meeting with the attorneys and the parties, because once you get everybody in a room, you start to see what really does need to have money spent on it and what doesn't. So that's kind of a semi-mediation. You can hire private mediators, either without your attorney or with, to try to achieve a result, and those are highly successful. And if you don't want to wait in line to go to court, you can get an arbitrator who will make final decisions, and that's usually quicker, which saves money as well.
I did want to ask you about kids, and of course that adds a whole different dimension to this divorce process. When is the best time to tell the kids? What do you recommend?
First of all, absolutely you must do it together as a couple. And you absolutely must agree in advance how you're going to tell them and what you're going to tell them. And you have to be in an emotional position where one person doesn't break down crying in front of the children. So the timing is not as important as the presentation. And you have to judge, you know, based on the ages of your children. But you want to reassure them that everything is going to be okay, that you are still a family that's going to be living in separate houses, but you will still be a family unit. That is so important. And you cannot place blame on each other, even if you're the one who didn't want this. And that first message you give the children will resonate throughout the entire divorce. That's one of the most important pieces. If you say your children are your number one priority, make it so from the beginning of your divorce on.
What if the kids ask you why you're getting divorced? Is it dad that wants the divorce or mom getting the divorce, especially if they're a little bit older?
I think this is a time when, no matter the age of the children, if we're still talking, you know, a minority child under college, absolutely you should just say, that's between your dad and I, or that's between your mom and I. This is a joint decision that's going to be better for both of us. I don't even know, college age and above, do they really need to know what went on privately with mom and dad? Probably not. Your job as the parent, no matter what their age, is to protect them, not guilt them, not involve them, not engage them in the battle. Protect them and let them know this is still a family. It just doesn't look the same as it did.
Angie Hollier, family law attorney and author of The Wiser Divorce, Positive Strategies for Your Next Best Life. Many thanks for sharing your thoughts and advice.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In 1683, Talbot County, Maryland, located on the state's eastern shore, established the Oxford Bellevue Ferry Service for horses and men. 331 years later, it remains the oldest privately owned running ferry in the United States. Captains Judy and Tom Bixler own and operate this historic gem. Judy joins us from the ferry to shoot the breeze about their real-life fairy tales. Welcome aboard, Judy.
Great to be with you.
So, Judy, I've always wanted to ask someone this. How long have you actually been a seafaring captain?
We've owned the ferry for 13 years now, and that's how long I've been doing this.
Now, how did you all come upon this ferry ownership idea?
My husband, Tom, was a ferry boat captain when he was in college. That was his summer job. And he said someday this is what he'd really like to do for a living. So we sought out our fairy tale, and we found the Oxford Bellevue Ferry, which belonged to David and Valerie Bittner at that time. And Valerie's dad actually talked my husband Tom into getting his license back when he was 19. So it's a real small world story.
So was this kind of a midlife career reinvention for you and Tom?
It is. It's our retirement job. We don't make a lot of money, but we have a lot of fun.
So, Judy, have you always loved the water?
Well, my husband likes to tell people I didn't know which end of an oar to hold on to when he married me. I don't think I was quite that bad, but I really didn't have a lot of boating experience until a few years ago. And at that time, I studied and worked hard on vessels out on Shelter Island, other ferries, in order to get enough time to be able to get my 100-ton master's license to be able to run our ferry.
100-ton? So, is that how big that ferry is?
The ferry is actually 30 feet wide and 65 feet long. And then we carry 9 vehicles most of the time. We've actually had 18 Mini Coopers on board one Sunday, just as a lark, to see how many we could fit.
You could be in the Guinness Book of World Records with that one.
I don't know. We don't know how many smart cars we could hold. We haven't found enough yet.
Oh, good. Now, while you probably don't ferry horses these days, you do ferry men, but you must have had some unusual guests on board, haven't you?
We have. During our tenure, we have movie stars. We've had the vice president, the secretary of defense, and then it boiled down to even a little lady who had a she was committed in her lawnmower. She had the lawns on both sides of the ferry that she would mow. She'd come on board with her lawnmower. So you never know who's going to be aboard our ferry.
And we heard something about a fire truck boarding your ferry.
We did. A few years ago, there was a fire on board a vessel, and the fire truck was on board in order to put the fire out. And then when we had a lighted boat parade a couple of years ago, we put a fire truck on board and created a fanfare by shooting the hoses off and had the ferry floating down the river for everyone to see.
As I am a local to that wonderful community of ours, we would actually put our children on board the ferry, sans parents, and the ferry would shuttle our children across the river. Does that still go on?
It does still go on. We have a number of young folks that come over to the sailing school over at the yacht club, and their mom or dad will drop them off at the ferry, and we take them across. We take across crabs and clams every now and then for the Robert Morris Inn. They'll drop those off at the dock, and we'll bring them across the river. So we have lots of unusual things going on our ferry.
Children and crabs.
Yes. What could be better?
Judy's probably thinking, oh, so you're the parent that kept dropping their kid off on my ferry, huh?
Not a problem. We enjoy it. We actually get to know the young people, and it's really a lot of fun. If possible, sometimes we let the kids come up into the wheelhouse to see what the ferry's all about.
Oh, that's where my kids used to ride. They loved it.
It is a true double-ended ferry. We have two engines, two propellers, two rudders. So it's different. Two wheels in the wheelhouse. I just pin one wheel and turn around and go in the other direction. So it's interesting.
Well, Judy, there must be lots of joys and challenges of owning such a boat. Can you share one of your favorite fairy tales with us?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I think one of the most fun things that we do is watching all the water. We go out and we waltz with the watermen. We're out on the water every day with the gentlemen catching crabs. We have the sailing school that's going in front of our ferry, and we watch the big wide-eyed kids come up below. We have wildlife. There's osprey and eagles and heron, and we've even had dolphin up the river. There's just so many things that go on. We've had a couple that were celebrating their anniversary, and we turned the radio on with them. They did the anniversary waltz on the deck. So there's lots and lots of tales. We like people to send us their fairy tales and tell us stories that have gone on when they're on the ferry, because we think that's all a part of our history.
And Judy, would you do it all over again?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely love it. People say, don't we get bored? But it's never boring. We meet people from all over the world, and it's really a lot of fun. I really don't want to give it up. Tom and I hope to run it until we can't anymore.
Well, Judy Bixler, captain of the oldest privately owned ferry in the United States, thanks so much for sharing your fairy tales with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you, ladies. It's been a pleasure.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154. And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes twoboomerbabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.
Women now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
Harvard Medical School has now opened its doors to new female applicants.
The first woman is now in space.
The majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far.
But our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.